Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. This hour, we're talking with three authors featured at this year's Nantucket Book Festival. Later in the hour, Nat Philbrick and Jessica Bruder. But first, Patriot fans might recognize the name Malcolm Mitchell as the team's wide receiver, but he's also known for his work inspiring the next generation of readers through his program, Read with Malcolm. Malcolm Mitchell joins us on the phone. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, now, as an adolescent and young adult, you worked hard at athletics and excelled. And then in your freshman year in college, you realized you weren't having the same kind of success in the classroom as you were on the field. Now, some athletes might not be concerned about academics and focus on what they can do well. So what made you want to achieve academically? Why was that important to you?
Well, my main goal, and I think a lot of our main goals in life, is just to pull the best out of ourselves, right? To leave no stone unturned, to truly go out and live the best life you can live. And football was something that I've been playing, or I had been playing, for many, 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 many of years. And I've given that a ton of focus, but I started to realize the results of neglecting, you know, my education. As soon as I got thrusted into an environment where that became just as important as athletics. So once I noticed that, I wanted to make a difference because I didn't want to succeed in one area in life and fail in another, because that wouldn't be considered being the best person you could be.
Yeah. Now, you decided to join a book club, and if that wasn't enough out of your comfort zone, you joined a book club comprised of women old enough to be your mother. So describe your book club and some of the books that you read and how it impacted you.
Yeah, I joined a book club to really surround myself around readers, hoping that it would rub off on me to want to continue that journey. And it did. I read a ton of books, The Orphan Train, All the Light We Cannot See, Me Before You, After You. I mean, I can name a list full of them. And some books I would have never picked up and read if I would not have been in that group. But what it really allowed me to do is explore different areas of life, enter the lives of different characters that I wouldn't have if I would not have been in the group. Right. And what that allowed me to do is begin to see the world in a brand new way, opening my mind to all the opportunities it offered, even outside of athletics, which inspired me to go on and write.
Yeah, and you wrote the children's book, The Magician's Hat. So give us a synopsis of the book and what prompted you to write that.
The Magician's Hat is a book that takes place at a library. It's where a magician comes to perform some tricks. But his favorite trick is not pulling a rabbit out of a hat, but showing kids through reading they can accomplish their goals. What inspired the book is my own personal journey into reading. Once I began to read, I began to understand how it truly helped me become the person that I was striving to be. It's still helping me today. Even being a football player, it made me a better athlete. It just increased the amount of knowledge that I could retain and apply almost immediately.
So what were you hoping to accomplish when you created Read with Malcolm? You know, how did you determine which reading initiatives would be most effective?
Well, when I immediately thought how I wanted to impact the world, I knew it would be through reading, because that's how my life was impacted in a very strong way. And when I start to really look at the circumstances that kids are placed in, some of the realities that they face, similar to what I faced when I was a kid, because I met every statistic. I was in an impoverished area. I just had one parent at home, and there wasn't a ton of books. So if I truly believe that reading is this key component, this key element to helping someone truly pull the best out of themselves, well, they got to have books to do it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And one of the big problems is that kids don't have access to books.
Yeah.
So Read with Malcolm is a youth literacy initiative that I started to promote reading relentlessly, but and also decrease the number of kids that don't have age-appropriate books at home. Mm-hmm. Once I started this initiative, it inspired me to create Share the Magic Foundation, where we raise money to try to increase the number of kids who have books at home.
Yeah. Now, Read with Malcolm has a number of programs designed to increase literacy in children. Tell us more about the First Grader Initiative and the Reading Ambassador Program.
Right. So the first grade initiative was created around this third grade statistic that's mind-boggling, actually. You know, there's a statistic, and studies prove that if kids aren't reading effectively by third grade, they're more likely to drop out of high school, be incarcerated, and that leads to other terrible, terrible outcomes. And there's actually a correlation between the number of kids who don't read effectively at a third grade level and the amount of jail cells that are built in that community. Mm. So the first grade initiative was started to try to catch kids before they get to third grade. If I could get their attention, if I can create an environment or a huge influence that makes books even approachable at an earlier age, by the time they get to third grade, they'll be more willing to read and be more accepting of having books around them, or even want books around them.
Yeah, Reading Ambassador Program.
The Reading Ambassador Program is where we have volunteers, or some high schools actually have adopted the program, where older kids will go and preach that same message that reading can truly help them. Try to introduce kids to books. So it'll be an older audience going down to a younger audience to mentor them, to try to help them understand the role that reading can play in their life.
Now, you also have a national reading contest called Read Bowl. This past year, 5,200 students from 180 schools participated, and Beck Hickman's sixth grade class at Cyrus Pierce Middle School on Nantucket won the middle school competition. So tell us more about this national reading contest and how winners are selected.
So Read Bowl was created last year around the National Championship and the Super Bowl. And it's really just to increase the motivation to read. We track the reading minutes, the amount of readers, and we actually have three different conferences to separate the readers. So we have elementary school, middle school, high school. And they compete with each other to see who can read the most minutes. And the teachers track it. They fill out forms. They send them in. We look at them, and we determine the winner based on who's read the most. And someone in Nantucket won.
Now, we all remember summer reading programs. Not the most exciting summer activity for many kids. So you're trying to change that with a new reading camp where you'll be head coach. Just tell us more about that.
Yeah, so summer slide is a big problem. Obviously, during the summer, most people are outside taking vacation, so they might forget about reading. And I can understand that because, I'm only 24. It wasn't long ago while I was in the same situation. But, you know, reading camp is to try to make sure that they still understand throughout the summer you have to read. And we'll be running different programs throughout the summer to try to motivate kids to read at home.
Now, when reading doesn't come easily for some kids, they look at it as a chore or boring. So what advice do you give kids to keep them persevering?
I try to help them understand how every goal that they have, whatever dream that they want to accomplish, that reading can help them. Mm-hmm. I know as a child growing up, you know, I met every statistic, and it really helps me because I thought the same exact way that they're thinking now. Mm-hmm. The only difference is I was lucky enough to have this light go off in my head so I can really, really understand exactly what they're feeling.
Yeah.
But I know for me, once I realized and I felt the change that reading was making in my life, it made me want to do it more.
Yeah.
So that's the same thing that I try to tell the kids. Now, when I'm talking to first graders, after you use different vernaculars, then when I'm talking to high schoolers, but at the end of the day, the mission and goal is the same, is that reading can truly help you, you know, increase your value of life and also increase the possibilities of you accomplishing the goals that you want to reach.
Right. And you describe that light going off, and I can even remember myself as a kid. You know, that first book, that it's like magic in your mind. All of a sudden, you're in this other world, whatever that might be. And for it's different kids, it's different things. You know, Nancy Drew mysteries were big for me when I was a kid. And for some kids, it was Harry Potter. I mean, there's all kinds of really inspiring stuff that can really spark their imagination. So now, when you meet children, is it difficult to get them to focus on books and reading and not pepper you with questions about football and the Patriots?
You know, it depends. You know, when I walk into a classroom, or when I walk in anywhere, you know, that's the first thing that, you know, people will mention, because it's, you know, football is one of the most popular sports in America, if not the most. I think it's behind soccer, maybe. So there's a lot of attention given to it, and I understand that. But football is an avenue for someone to cheer for. You know, we go out there, we play. It's exciting. It's entertainment. But I try to get them to understand that, you know, football is great. All sports are great. You know, but, you know, there's more to life that can help you accomplish other things outside of athletics. Yeah. So sometimes I walk into a school and then I get riddled with football questions. By the time I leave, it's all reading questions. just depends on, you know, where I'm at and how good of a job I do.
Yeah, and there are children who have dreams of becoming professional athletes. They hear about multi-million-dollar contracts, and you know, for some kids, especially in some of the inner city and lower income areas, they see that as an avenue out of that poverty. And so for them, reading and schoolwork, they sometimes don't correlate that with success. So what do you tell these kids?
Yeah, well, I was that child. You know, I'll never tell a kid not to pursue their dream, because if someone had told me that, who knows where I'd be. You know, my mom encouraged me to pursue anything that I want to. And I tell every kid that when I meet them, if you want to be a football player, be a football player. I'm not going to tell you not to. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to quote some statistic that's out there. I'm going to tell you, listen, being a football player is great. If you really want to be the best football player you can do, you probably should read, because I can guarantee you there's not one really, 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 really good, successful football player that is not smart in some way.
Right.
Because there are a lot of things that take place off the field that require an education or some form of equipping yourself with the knowledge to make the best decisions. So it doesn't matter if you want to be a football player. That's the great thing about reading. It doesn't matter what you want to do.
Right.
It will help you. And if I get challenged with that, I just give them examples in my life, because I wouldn't be where I'm at playing football. You know, I truly believe that if I didn't adopt the love for reading in some way.
Yeah. And, I'm just so inspired by your work at such a young age, Malcolm. It's really a great thing you're doing to help children become great readers. And Malcolm Mitchell will be on Nantucket as part of the Nantucket Book Festival. We'll have more information about his organization, Read with Malcolm, and the many different reading programs and contests at our website, capeandislands.org. Malcolm Mitchell, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for doing what you're doing.
Thank you, and go Pats.
Coming up after a break, we talk with Nathaniel Philbrick about his book, Second Wind.
Award-winning author Nathaniel Philbrick has lived on Nantucket for the last, 32 years, I think
it
is
32.
Now. His previous books are based on history, but also America's relationship to the sea. This one is a more personal voyage. Second Wind, a sunfish, sailor, an island, and the voyage that brought a family together. Welcome back. Always good to see you.
Oh, it's great to be here again.
So I'm not a sailor, but I am fascinated by the sunfish, and you've given me some inspiration to try it. But when you think racing and sunfish, that I didn't know you could race.
Right. It's sort of like racing a mini car, you know, around the track or something like that. No, it's for me, it's primal sailing. You know, it is the absolute essential. It's you, that little boat. Oh, you weigh more than the boat, so you can really make it do things with your body. And you can take it anywhere. It's cheap, it's affordable, and I think they're the best sailboat in the world.
I say challenging, right? I mean,
oh,
yeah. Very challenging.
And they really have, they perform, they're fast. And if you're a kid, you can have immense fun capsizing them and riding them and just getting into trouble. And if you're a serious racer, it's one of the great boats. So,
right. And I don't know if people remember, but you and your wife, Melissa, actually met sailing here on the Cape.
Yes, in West Falmouth, the Chappaquoit Yacht Club. We were, Melissa was 17, I was 18, and we were hired as sailing instructors. And yeah. So, and
the rest is history.
The rest is history.
So you both had this love of sailing. And right. At 22, you won the 1978 North American Championship, beating out 178 other Sunfish sailors.
Yes.
And so you moved to Nantucket, you and Melissa, and she's an attorney. She continued her career, and you became a stay-at-home dad. And I knew the right, but I don't think I knew about the stay-at-home dad stuff. So in 1992, you're home with the kids, two kids, and you were watching the America's Cup. And how did that get you thinking about racing again? America's Cup, Sunfish, they're like, you know.
Well, you know, the
opposite
irony.
Ends.
Yeah, the irony is that as a Sunfish sailor, I thought the America's Cup was the most stupid thing possible. You know, all these billionaires. Well, I don't think we had billionaires back then, but who, you know, spend a lot of money and it's elite and all, you know, it was stupid. But here I was with the kids. You know, I had stop sailing. I was a stay-at-home dad, and I thought there'd be a lot of stay-at-home dads. No, I was it. And so, you know, I was trying to write, but if you've been at home with kids, you know, you lose 25 IQ points and you really, and so I was, you know, everything was sort of stalled. It was good to be with the kids, but but the America's Cup was on TV, and it had never been. It was on ESPN, and it was the weekday afternoon, usually the time the kids usually watch the Mickey Mouse Club at 5 o'clock. And so I'm watching the America's Cup, and I'm going, "Why am I watching this?" And the kids go up and say, "Can we watch the Mickey Mouse?" And I said, "No, I'm watching the America's Cup." And they said, "Well," my daughter says, "Well, get a life, Dad." And then I began to go, "Wow, maybe I need to get a life." And maybe it has to do with sailing. You know, maybe this is part of the problem here.
Yeah. And now Melissa and the kids were racing in a borrowed Beetle Cat and having a pretty good summer. Lots of blue ribbons.
Yes.
And they were like, well, maybe we need some other colors.
Right. I mean, they're winning. And they're doing way too well.
Yeah. And so tell us about the Gordon incident.
Well, you know, it was that summer. So it was just after that sort of revelation. And I was actually working at the Nantucket Yacht Club. And not sailing, and watching my kids and my wife clean up in the Beetle Cat was just driving me nuts. And they were doing so well. It was just, they were insufferable. So there was a guy named Gordon who was in the Beetle Cat class. He wasn't doing too well. And I said, Gordon, would you like me to crew for you? Maybe I can give you some tips in one race. And he says, sure. So I make sure that he's over on the other side of the course where Melissa can't see to get in his boat. And then we appear at the starting line. And the kids go, whoa, Daddy, what's going on? I'm listening to exactly what I was up to. And so from there unfolded the most titanic race of all time, because, you know, I was trying to meet Melissa and the kids, and it was back and forth, attacking duel to the death. And of course Melissa and the kids won.
Yeah. And would have won by a much bigger margin. Yes. Had she not gone back for Jenny's hat. That
right. I mean, go figure. The hat, you know, the kid's hat falls off and she goes back
and
to
gets
get it.
It,
I mean, you don't do that in a race. And so, yeah, it was in your face kind of thing.
So you have this really competitive side.
I do.
Yeah.
And not a lot of people are aware of it, but I been compared to Ahab, and it's a kind of version of insanity. It's temporary, but when I'm on the race course, it emerges.
So this kind of got your competitive juices flowing again, and you thought, hey, maybe I can go back to that Sunfish racing. And this year it was going to be held in Springfield, Illinois, and so to prepare. You decide, now what, you were 36 at this time?
Yeah.
30s? Okay, so you want to go back and be your 22-year-old self.
Yes.
So to prepare,
always a bad idea.
And I thought it was interesting, you still had the Sunfish that you won with in 1978. Now it's got ivy, it's up against the house, and yeah, so you've got this old Sunfish, and you decide that you're going to sail all the ponds on the island,
right.
Which I didn't realize, 20 ponds.
Yeah, no, and the Springfield, Illinois, North Americans was on a man-made lake, and so I figured, hey, I'm on an island with the highest wind velocity on the East Coast. I don't want to sail in the ocean, but these ponds would be a perfect training ground. And that year, I was working on my first work of history, away offshore. And so a lot of things were coming together for me, finally, relatively late in life. And so I was researching the island, and I realized this would be a way to explore the island I was writing about. And so each week, I would sail on a different pond. And it took me all over the island. And even if the weather was lousy, at mm-hmm. one point a pond was frozen, and
right.
I still threw in the sunfish and broke up the ice. But it was quite a journey.
Yeah. Now some of those vegetables pretty cold, dangerous.
Yeah.
I mean, you had some dangerous conditions there. A lot's changed since 1978 in regards to equipment.
Right. No, this was a long time ago. This is a tale from a long ago. This was before cell phones. This was before a lot of the equipment we have now in terms of dealing with the cold. And so, yeah, it was, you know, I remember at one point I was on this tiny little pond head of hummock, which is about, it's a postage stamp, and it was blowing 35 knots. And the wind was going around in circles. I was literally going around in circles. The water was freezing on me as I was sailing. And it was nuts. It was crazy. Mm. But I was very organized and regimented, and it was an amazing experience. I look back at it now and say, who was this crazy man?
Sakacha.
Well,
okay. I was in it going, are you crazy?
Yeah, this was where I really went over the line. Even I admit it. But on Nantucket, we have this tradition of opening the ponds to the ocean, which means equipment goes out, you make a cut, and the pond gushes out, and eventually it's the sand fills in and it rises again. But I decided that I was going to sail through the cut at Sakacha, and it was nuts because I really didn't understand the forces involved. The river, the water had created a river about an eighth of a mile wide. I mean, it was immense, and it was really rushing. And everyone was saying, don't do it, don't do it. My wife and children were watching. Bruce, who was the head of the Conservation Commission, was saying, no, don't go. And of course, I went. Not quite realizing that at the end of it was a sandbar where waves from Portugal were bursting. And so I hit the sandbar. My centerboard was up. My rudder was up. The first wave spun me around, hit me, capsized me. And I thought the rig had been taken out, and the water just blew me out.
Yeah.
And so I was about a quarter mile, half mile out before I righted the boat. Luckily, the sail and mast were still there, and I was able to sail back. If it hadn't been, it would have been called the Coast Guard, I guess.
You really had this sort of conversation with yourself before you did it. You kind of went by the cut. You were going, not going to go through, and then all of a sudden, something inside you said, yep, I'm going for it.
Yeah, that's when I realized this is a midlife crisis. I mean, this was, but I have, you know, it's like a teenager. Wow, it was stupid, but what a rush. I mean, it was really amazing. So, was a...
So you write, I was beginning to see that there were limits to my winter sailing. For one thing, the ever-worsening weather made it increasingly difficult to maintain any semblance of concentration beyond an hour or so of sailing. But it wasn't just the cold. There was a corrosive sense of desolation, a blankness out there at the edge of this offshore island that no dry suit could overcome.
Yeah, yeah. And, no, and you know, it was also a part of my, you know, where I was in life. You know, I was so pent up. And I really, through the book, through the sailing, I really wanted to, you know, start a new chapter. And, you know, Nantucket in the winter, it gets to you, mm-hmm. particularly by March.
Yeah.
I mean, it is corrosive.
Yeah.
We call March on Nantucket Hate Month because by then the rumors have gotten to the point that everybody is really angry with one another. But and so it matched where I was, and that's when I realized, hey, I need to do something different. So I went to the Sunfish Midwinters in Florida, which was, let's say, disheartening return to competition. I realized I have a lot to do. But the fun part was I realized I need to involve the family.
Yeah.
And the Sunfish has this great tradition of the Connecticut River Race.
Right, which you did with Melissa and the kids.
Right. So we borrowed a boat from my parents. And so we had two boats. And the way it works is it's two people per boat. And it's 50 miles. And you camp overnight. And so you have to have all your equipment on your Sunfish, which you put in garbage bags, which you put on the deck, and they divide it into five races, and you race down the river. And Ethan was my crew. Ethan was seven. Jenny was Melissa's crew. She was 10. And we raced down the river, and it was wonderful.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to talk about this kind of. You also talk in the book a lot about growing up, and your parents sailed. You sailed with your brother. That was sort of the first introduction to the sunfish. So you make this connection between your sailing / racing and the importance of family. So your family growing up, and then of course your family now. So you write, the more I thought about it, the more I realized that sailing had always been inextricably tied to family, and any attempt to separate the two would be like setting up a Berlin Wall across the interior of my brain.
Yeah, yeah. No, it really was a realization that, wow, you know, I thought it was about me, but it really, I couldn't do it without the family somehow, and which was kind of cool, and yeah. I really hadn't thought that through.
Yeah.
And it took a year of sailing on those desolate ponds to realize, no, I have to, you know, have to involve the family somehow.
Yeah, there's such a sweetness there in the story about your family. I really enjoyed getting to know your family from a different angle, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's a little excruciating for the family now, yeah. Having to relive it so many years later.
All right, so you decide you're going to do this. Talk about Paul Fendler.
Paul Fendler.
You get this tap on the shoulder, right?
Yeah. Well, I went to the North Americans way out in Illinois. I was borrowing a boat. And when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, my main rival was Paul Fendler. He had won the Worlds. And then at the North Americans, I won there. But then at another Worlds, he beat me. You know, we were just back and forth. And we were almost exactly the same age. And, you know, we had completely lost touch. We weren't really that close because we were so competitive. And then I'm at the North Americans in Springfield, and someone taps me on the shoulder, and oh my God, it's Paul Fendler.
You really are back in 1978.
Yeah, right. And he had decided to come back. I mean, it was just eerie, you know, yeah. Why? Well, we couldn't figure it out, but there we were. And so, and it was so great to see him.
Yeah.
And darn it, he beat me.
I want to go back to the Florida too. When you went to Florida, and just sort of all of a sudden you're back in a competition. You're looking around. You're seeing all these boats. And was it Florida? You had somebody else's boat.
Yes, yeah, I was borrowing a boat.
And so
yeah.
I mean, here's a boat you're not maybe so familiar with, and you see a lot of people that were doing the sunfish racing back in the 70s.
Right.
So were you surprised that there were so many people that kind of had the same idea that you did?
Yeah. Well, I was surprised at how many people, were still doing it. And it was amazing to me. This had been 15 years, and I could immediately recognize them in a boat. You know, by their mm-hmm. posture, it was like, whoa, you know, taking me back to my 20s. And yeah, and that's one of the great things about the sunfish. It is a family class. So many racing boats now, it's for kids only, mm-hmm. Optimist or 420, and then there are adult boats. And it's divided the sport in a way that I don't think is healthy. Mm-hmm. Beetle cats and sunfish are great because you get all ages in mm-hmm. them, and it's a life skill kind of thing. But yeah, so it was great to see some old timers
yeah.
that weren't old timers, but were becoming them.
Now, you don't have the sunfish anymore.
No, we donated it to the Nantucket Community Sailing.
But you are still using your beetle cat.
Yes, we're still on the water. We've actually traded it. We sold the beetle cat and now have a Herreshoff 12
right.
and a half.
Right.
It's a little
yeah.
more comfortable. The back gets to you once you're
yeah.
in your 60s.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we took our 2-year-old granddaughter sailing in the boat just last summer, so it was great.
Continue interesting. So as much as a win would be nice, you set your goal as finishing in the top 10. So does he do it? The book is Second Wind, A Sunfish Sailor, An Island, and the Voyage That Brought a Family Together. We'll have to read the book to find out. Nat Philbrick, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks. It's been really great to see you again.
Coming up after a break, we talk with Jessica Bruder about her book, Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with authors who will be appearing at the Nantucket Book Festival. Jessica Bruder is a journalist who reports on subcultures and economic justice. She also teaches at Columbia Journalism School. She's the author of Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century, and she joins us on the phone. Welcome.
Thank you, Mindy. Thanks for having me.
Sure. This is a story of transient workers, mostly retirement age folks, who are part of a growing community of nomads living in RVs, travel trailers, and vans, migrating to various jobs that are not only physically demanding, but they don't pay very much. This is not the vision most of us have of seniors traveling around in RVs. So how did you discover this group, which we should say consists of tens of thousands of people?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I had the same vision that I think many of your listeners might have had of RV culture. And just, you know, when I see an RV go by, I think they're going to last. They're the great pensioners. They're going to see Niagara Falls. They're going to the Grand Canyon. That's cool. But what I started encountering a few years ago was I basically read a story where somebody was in an Amazon warehouse and spoke with somebody who said, I am living full-time in an RV, and I do this job because I can't afford to retire. And there's a whole program for people like us. And the story went back to a much more general take. At that point, I kind of got stuck there.
Yeah.
In that, you know, knowing what we know about the failures of retirement finance, about the economic collapse in 2008, about the fact that housing prices keep going up while wages are flat. And when I started digging into this particular program, which Amazon calls Camper Force, I realized not only had it started in the months following the Great Recession and the housing crash, but that it was part of a much larger ecosystem of jobs like this, who hire people they call work campers, who are living full-time out of their vehicles, most of the time at or nearing retirement age, but really can't afford to kick back and are often doing some pretty challenging jobs to keep gas in the tank and food on the table.
Yeah, you're right. From a distance, many of them could be mistaken for carefree retired RVers. On occasions when they treat themselves to a movie or dinner at a restaurant, they blend in with the crowd. In mindset and appearance, they are largely middle class. They wash their clothes at laundromats and join fitness clubs to use the showers. Many to the road after seeing their savings were obliterated by the Great Recession. To keep their gas tanks and bellies full, they work long hours at hard physical jobs in a time of flat wages and rising housing costs. They have unshackled themselves from rent and mortgages as a way to get by. They are surviving America. For these folks, hope is on the road. And it's interesting because some people might say, well, they're homeless, but they prefer to call themselves houseless.
Absolutely. There's such a stigma on the word homeless in our culture. It doesn't mean what it purports to mean, that you don't have a house. It's really a modern day caste system marker. It's a way of saying less than. It's a way of saying you screwed up. In a particularly brutal economy where people are often told that, okay, yeah, it's kind of a casino out there, but if you aren't crushing it, you screwed up, you're lazy, you're bad. There are all sorts of corrosive myths and stereotypes surrounding poverty. And in my mind, it's just no wonder that people don't have any desire to associate themselves. They've taken agency. They've gotten out on the road. They've eliminated what for most of us is our biggest living cost, which is housing, and they have transportation and shelter. So, you know, homelessness is a club that nobody wants to be a member of, and they prefer to call themselves houseless.
Now, there's no count of how many people live nomadically in America, but in your travels, give us a sense of what you saw.
So all sorts of people out there, a lot of the people doing the hard jobs were at or nearing retirement age, and that was the cohort I first encountered. Also, I met, you know, millennials who had either said, you know, I don't want to go to college and incur all this debt when there are no good jobs out there and I'll never be able to pay it back. People who dealt with, you know, everything from divorce to medical debt to credit card debt to just like, you know, unexpected illnesses that had kind of knocked them out of the house, middle class, to people who said, well, you know, I can't afford to live the way society is telling me to live anymore. And besides, we live in a consumer culture where we're polluting the earth, we're taking more than we need. We live in a largely disposable culture. So what if I could save myself and become more minimal at the same time? So a lot of different overlapping demographics out there.
Yeah, and also just like kind of getting a handle on the numbers, the president of the Recreation Resource Management, which manages 110 campgrounds, said there's like 25,000 people applying, which is really 50,000 because most of them are couples. So he's got 50,000 people applying for 50 jobs, and
that's just one employer.
That's one, yeah.
So, yeah, I try to be really conservative in my numerical estimates just because I'm not a hyperbolic kind of gal, but it's challenging when you think about how many people are out there because these folks are a demographer's nightmare. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to have
a kind of fake address. You need to be, quote unquote, domiciled somewhere in order to vote, in order to get your driver's license, in order to get insurance, pay taxes. So everybody needs an address, whether or not they're spending time there, but it means it's really hard to get firm numbers on these people.
Right. So tell us about the jobs. The most aggressive recruiter you found was Amazon's Camper Force, and they make it sound like a vacation.
Yeah, a lot of these jobs do that. I mean, one of the interesting things about Amazon is, you know, I've interviewed folks in their 70s who are walking 15 miles a day, and the jobs get marketed back to people in terms of camaraderie and staying active. And you see the people actually picking up the jargon too, saying, this is like a free fitness program. One guy talking about losing 50 pounds. But, you know, when you visit people who are doing this work and you step inside one of the RVs, often they're kitted out like mobile apothecaries with Epsom salts and soaking tubs for tired feet and all sorts of free generic painkillers, which over-the-counter ones actually come for free in the warehouse. There's a dispenser called a Lil Medic where you can go get your generic, you know, aspirins and ibuprofen. So it's really quite hard work.
Yeah. You follow one of the characters, Linda May, in your book. Tell us a little bit about Linda.
Yeah, Linda's amazing. Linda has held every job under the sun, from cocktail waitress to insurance executive to owner of a flooring store to she was defailing ducks and quails at a hunting lodge. You name it, Linda's done it. And also, like many women by their mid-60s, which is how old she is now, she spent a fair amount of time out of the workforce doing the unpaid labor of caregiving, whether for her children as a single mother or for her own mother when her mother was ill with cancer. So when Linda realized that her Social Security checks were going to amount to just under $500 a month, that her job prospects were dwindling due in part to ageism in the workplace. She had been a project manager at Home Depot and then, you know, saw that she moved and then they would only let her work the register and the shifts were kind of, you know, few and far in far between. She said to herself, well, you know, she's going to be on that treadmill and working till the day she dies. She wanted an alternative. So she went online and discovered this website called cheaprvliving.com basically encountered the philosophy of this guy named Bob Wells, who was forced into living out of a box truck after he found himself supporting two separate households following a divorce, and went and took what at the time seemed like pretty dramatic misfortune. You know, he cried himself to sleep at night and kind of converted it to minimalism and found himself getting really used to it, building a community around it, and then, you know, finding other like-minded people. So Linda found his website, and that really planted a seed in her that she was going to get out on the road and that might bridge her into something that looked a little bit more like a retirement.
Yeah, I really admired Linda reading her story, but she was just one of several strong women that you met. And I suppose it's not a surprise, looking at women's earnings, that we'd find a lot of women in this situation. But were you surprised at the strength that's not, and I guess some of the men too, but some of these women had, like Linda? I mean, she was so strong and so optimistic.
Linda's amazing. And it's funny, one of my best friends was actually following the dispossessed and riding the rails and going all over the country back in the 80s. And he always told me, you never saw solo women back then. And he was constantly surprised when I was, you know, bringing home these reports of single women, often older, on the road and doing it for themselves. And as you mentioned, when you look at the numbers for retirement finance and, you know, the lifetime gender wage gap, what that means for savings, women outliving men, women doing most of the unpaid labor of caregiving. All those numbers add up to a picture where it shouldn't be surprising to see so many women out on the road. But considering that, you know, all the great road stories, or many of them, I should say, because I'm sure there are many I haven't encountered, but so many of the canonical road books have all been about men or from a male perspective. So seeing these women on the road was kind of... it seemed like an opportunity to write a bit of a different kind of book, one that brought those strong female characters to the fore. And that was something I was glad to have the opportunity to do.
Yeah, and you mentioned Bob Wells and cheaprvliving.com, which is really interesting. You write, he envisioned a future where economic and environmental upheavals had become the new American normal. For this reason, he didn't package nomadic living as a quick fix, something to tide folks over until society had stabilized, at which point they could reintegrate with the mainstream. Rather, he aspired to create a wandering tribe whose members could operate out of or even transcend the fraying social order, a parallel world on wheels. And the services or the tips and things that he provides just runs the gamut.
Oh, it's amazing. And there's just so much good sharing and kind of crowdsourced participation, both online and at the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous, which is this annual gathering he's been doing for a while, which when I first got out there, gosh, I think it was January of 2014, there were maybe only 60 vehicles at this event. There were thousands of them last year.
Yeah.
It's grown exponentially. And when people get out there, they share all sorts of skills from, you know, if I need to, quote unquote, stealth park or stealth camp in an urban area, how do I do that? How do I sleep on a public street in my vehicle without getting rousted by the police? Where are good places to go in the national forest? Where are good places to get cheap dental care in Mexico? Just everything you need to survive on the road while living on a shoestring budget is basically the kind of wisdom that these people are passing around.
Yeah. Talk about the camaraderie, because this is amazing. I mean, you mentioned you have people from all kinds of different walks of life. I guess I'm kind of thinking of Quartzsite for one. Tell us about that.
Yeah. You've got people, you see in Quartzsite, people who are pretty down and out, living in the same public desert as people with these ultra expensive mobile homes who are probably just, you know, out there on a lark, and, you know, the homes look like rock star tour buses. So just all sorts of range of people out there on what they call the long-term visitors area, which is just a giant swath of the Sonoran Desert where people can park and live and boondock, which means pretty much going off the grid. They don't have hookups for power or water. Lots of people are just bringing in jugs and using solar electricity because the prices come down so much on solar panels. And you essentially have this temporary encampment that swells every year when the weather in the rest of the country is pretty darn cold, mm-hmm. and it's quite pleasant there, and then dwindles when it starts getting really hot and the rattlesnakes come out and the jobs for work campers become available around the country.
Okay. So, yeah, and this is interesting. Open desert is federal territory, so you can camp free for 2 weeks. Then you have to move on to another patch of federal desert that's at least 25 miles away. And you write, it's estimated that more than 40,000 RVers dwell in the desert near Quartzsite from December through February. So what is what's the 25 miles? Why that rule? Do you know?
Yeah, so it's funny. There are a couple different kinds of zones out there. If you want to stay in something called the long-term visitors area, there's a pretty inexpensive, forgive me, I don't remember the exact figure, camping permit that will let you stay there for many months while the weather holds. But if you want to stay in a free area, there is this 25-mile thing where you're supposed to stay 2 months, the ranger keeps an eye on you, and afterwards you need to go somewhere else. And I think that is to keep people from settling for too long.
Mm-hmm.
And historically, there have been areas where the rangers kind of turned a blind eye. But as the numbers of people doing this seem to be increasing, the rangers have been cracking down more and more. And areas that are less scenic and appealing to casual tourists that went largely ignored in the past and became these enclaves of people who would stay there for months at a time, kind of out of the ranger's eye, that's changed a lot.
Yeah. You actually bought a secondhand vehicle and really kind of to sort of blend in and get to know these people more intimately. Do you still have it?
Yeah, I did. That wasn't originally the plan. And it's funny. I never wanted to blend in that everybody, apart from the very short section of the book where I'm actually undercover on a couple closed work sites, everybody I met right away, I told them what I was up to. I really had the van so I could spend a lot of time close to people. For practical reasons, I have something in there called a chemical toilet. If you don't have that level of self-containment, I was originally told the rangers won't let you kind of go way out into the backcountry. Now I probably know ways to get around that.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, you know, there was just that practicality of wanting to be self-contained and better able to relate to people I was writing about. But yeah, it's funny. I bought a low mileage vehicle. It's a 95 GMC Vandora that had been already undergone a camper conversion. And I figured, hey, this is low mileage. I got it off Craigslist. I can unload it when the book is done. But the secret subtext to the book is a love story between a girl and her van. And that van is still in my life.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned how these nomads can blend in with the crowd, you know, when we go out to dinner or see a movie. But my guess is that's a lot easier if you are white. What did you find in this tribe for people of color?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I found was that there weren't many of them. And it's funny, online, you saw them interrogating each other, like, why are we so white? If you look at any of the pictures of, like, Amazon Camper Force, it's a pretty white population. If you look at, you know, even just the advertising material for the campground hosting jobs, again, it's all pretty white. And talking to people, I came to glean that was probably for a whole collection of reasons. One of them is when I was reporting the book, which I actually finished right before Trump took office, every other week, or sometimes every week, brought a headline where an unarmed African-American motorist was shot by the police for no discernible reason. So I think the road is a lot easier for, it's funny, you don't think of privilege when you think of living in a van necessarily,
right.
But there's definitely an element of that, particularly, you know, I met so many people down in the Southwest, and, you know, we've heard about Latinos getting stopped on the road for identification. Like, it can get pretty ugly out there for people of color. So that didn't surprise me. Also, so much about camping culture has been traditionally just marketed towards a white audience, and RV culture has always been pretty white.
Mm.
So I think it's a hybrid of that, of those different factors. Yeah.
Do you stay in touch with Linda or any of the other people you wrote about in the book?
Yeah, I talked to Linda yesterday. We talk all the time.
So you keep those friendships, yeah. And what I thought was interesting, you walk away, you're done, you're writing this book, but as you say, the story followed you home. You're noticing some of these nomads in right there in Brooklyn.
Oh, they're everywhere. They're everywhere. I also think that the culture has grown since I started looking at it, but also I know how to look. So it's the picture's evolving, but also I think so has the lens through which, you know, I regard it. You know what all the little tells on a van are that might show you someone's living there. You know about the strategies people use to, you know, just stay out of the public eye. And then you do see it everywhere.
Yeah, as you say, a camouflage, how to camouflage what you're doing. Now, what happens when somebody gets sick? I mean, this is a population that, you know, these are physical jobs a lot of them are doing. What happens when they get sick?
It's really hard when someone gets sick, particularly if that person is solo. I know cases where, gosh, I remember when Linda was sick and they were out boondocking in the desert and everybody was bringing her food and soup. I've seen situations where people pass the hat. I think that in many ways, GoFundMe has become our new healthcare system, which is kind of regrettable in a whole lot of ways. And you see that happening in this community. Even though people don't have a lot of means, they are quite open to supporting each other and often share what they have. Mm-hmm. But it's not easy. People often don't feel like they can fall back on their family members, but have to do it. And, you know, I heard of, in the span of my reporting, several people who passed away while they were still out on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens, too.
Yeah. The book is Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. We'll have more about the book and Jessica's talk at the Nantucket Book Festival at our website, capeandislands.org. Jessica Bruder, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you at the book festival.
I'm looking forward to it. Thanks.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.